So we have just read 1 Samuel chapter 20. And while it's a long chapter, it might seem like it's a rather pointless chapter. What is accomplished by this long and complicated story that we're told here? You know, if you're reading through 1 Samuel, by this point, you already know that Saul really wants to kill David. And yet here we have a 42-verse long chapter that seems to do nothing but confirm that fact. Saul wants David dead at the beginning of the chapter. He wants David dead at the end of the chapter. And it's like we go through this big circle. It doesn't really seem to go anywhere. We end up right back where we started. It might seem that this chapter doesn't really add anything. It's a long chapter. It tells a complicated story. Why is it included? Why are we told this particular story? Well, I would actually argue, believe it or not, that there is a lot going on here beneath the surface that's actually incredibly helpful, incredibly practical, and very instructive for us today. But first, before we can really see all of that, we've got to get a handle on what actually happens. And I know it can be hard to hear a story that long, so I want to walk you back through it and help you understand what's happening here. This chapter takes place across 4 days. On the first day, David and Jonathan make their plans. The feast then is the next 2 days, and then David finally makes his escape. He has his exodus on the fourth day. Remember, in the last chapter, David fled to Samuel. He's running away from Saul. He flees to Samuel, and Saul and his men pursue him there, and now David has come back to Jonathan's house, and he goes to Jonathan, and he asks, "What have I done that your father would seek to kill me? What have I ever done to Saul, your father, that would make him want to kill me?" Jonathan assures David, "You shall not die." And then he says, "My father would do nothing without telling me." Now, Jonathan may be a little bit naive here. He may not know, he certainly doesn't know all the facts. He's wrong in this claim, obviously. Why would Jonathan say something like this, that my father's not really seeking to kill you, he would let me know about it? Well, it may be that after the Spirit of God came upon Saul and caused him to prophesy at the end of chapter 19, that Jonathan thinks his father has finally had a real change of heart about David. Or it might be that he's thinking back to the vow, the oath that Saul made at the beginning of chapter 19, where he swore, "As the Lord lives, David will not be killed." Jonathan is thinking, you take an oath like that, surely you're not going to break it, because to break that vow would be to say that God doesn't live. The only way you could break that vow is if you're an atheist. And Jonathan is thinking, surely my father is not that far gone spiritually. Whatever the case, David corrects him under oath in verse 3. David swears and says, "Your father knows I have found favor in your sight." And so he's not telling you his plans, lest you be grieved. Your father knows about our friendship, and so he's not going to tell you about his plot to kill me. David goes on, he says, "There is but one step between me and death." He says, "I'm right on the edge of death. I've barely escaped death several times already, and it's like I continue to walk on really thin ice. I'm one step away from death." Jonathan says to David, "Whatever you do, whatever you ask, I'll do it." It's about to be a new moon festival or a new month festival. And so there would be a monthly gathering at the beginning of every month of a festival that would go on for at least a couple days, where King Saul and his men, King Saul and his inner circle, his cabinet, his group of nobles, they would all be present and they would feast together. Attendance at something like this would ordinarily be mandatory for someone like David. But David says he will intentionally miss the feast, and so they can use Saul's response to gauge where he is, how he views David at this point. David is going to intentionally violate court protocols, and then they'll see how Saul handles it, and then they'll know how Saul really feels about David. In verse 6, David asks Jonathan to tell a lie, to fabricate an alibi, a cover story for why David is not there. And again, I think this is one of those righteous deceptions. I'm not going to try to prove that to you here, but in my opinion, this is a justified deception. David says, "Tell Saul that I've gone to Bethlehem for a yearly sacrifice with my family." And then in verse 7, David reminds Jonathan of their covenant. He says, "If there is any iniquity in me, kill me yourself." That is, David says to Jonathan, if I have been plotting against Saul, or if I've sinned against Saul in some grievous way, I'd rather just have you kill me right now than have Saul kill me later. Jonathan responds in verse 9. He says, "If I knew that my father was going to do evil to you, I would tell you. I would let you know. Now, apparently they had been having this conversation, obviously in a private place, inside. Now they go out to the field. They walk out to the field. And when they are outside, Jonathan turns the tables and makes a request. So David has just made a request to Jonathan. Now Jonathan turns the tables and he has a request. Think about it. Right now, David is the helpless one looking to Jonathan for help. But Jonathan knows a day will come when David is king, when David ascends to the throne, and in that day, Jonathan's family will be helpless. And he knows that God will give David victory over his enemies when he exalts him to the throne. And Jonathan does not want himself or his family to be counted among those enemies when David comes to the throne. And so Jonathan calls on the Lord to be their witness in verse 12. He swears an oath. He says that, again, that if he knows that Saul is going to harm David, he's going to let David know, or he will be cursed. And Jonathan makes this new covenant with David, a covenant to protect David right now. But then he asks, then he gives his request, he asks that in the future that David would protect him and his household. And so in verse 15, he has David promise that David will not cut off loving kindness, hesed, covenant mercy. He will not cut off kindness to Jonathan's house, even when the Lord has cut David's enemies off of the face of the earth. See, the custom would be that when a new king came to power, this was in Israel and other nations, when a king would come to power, when a new dynasty was established, that new king's first order of business would be to kill all the remaining members of the previous king's family, all the remaining members of the previous dynasty, to eliminate the possibility of rivalry or treason so that the new king can basically start fresh without any rivals, without the potential of treason within his own kingdom. And so basically Jonathan is saying to David here, just as I'm going to protect you now, I want you to protect me then. Remember, when you come into your kingdom, remember me and my household. And David agrees to it. David confirms this covenant that he will indeed deal kindly with Jonathan's household when the throne is his. And if you're wondering, yes, David does keep that promise. If you skip ahead in the story, when David is king, you find that he is kind to the family of Jonathan. He treats Jonathan's children with love. And we'll see that when we get there. You see it in 2 Samuel chapter 9 and 2 Samuel chapter 21 especially. In all of this too, you see again this beautiful friendship between these two men. This beautiful friendship between Jonathan and David. How they serve one another. Verse 17 really sums it up. They make this covenant, and this covenant is confirmed, and it says they love, you know, each one loves the other as he loves his own soul. What beautiful language to describe friendship, to love another as you love your own soul. That's how David and Jonathan are with each other. These two men will do anything for each other. They will die for each other if need be. That's their friendship. Then in verse 18, they go back to making their plans. So remember, they started out talking about how they were going to make this plan to figure out how Saul really feels about David at this point. They go back to making their plan. How will they determine Saul's posture towards David? They need a way of communicating secretly. And so the plan is something like this. David will hide in the field where he can overhear things. On the third day, so that'd be the second day of the field, on the third day, Jonathan will shoot arrows into the field. And he'll send his servant to go fetch the arrows. And if he shoots the arrows close by, that's a sign that David is safe. David can come out of hiding. Everything's fine. Everything's good with Saul. If Jonathan shoots the arrows a long way off and then tells the servant to go get them, then David will know that Saul does want to kill him and that the Lord is sending him away. In a way, you could say this is how they're discerning the Lord's will. By this little test that they give to Saul. The Lord will be sending David away if Jonathan shoots the arrows at a great distance because the attitude of Saul has been discovered. Verse 23, the two again remember that the Lord is between them, that the Lord is the real bond of their friendship. The Lord is between the two of them forever. That's one of the great things about Christian friendship. It is eternal. It is an everlasting friendship. Verse 24, they begin to carry out the plan. So David goes and he hides in the field while King Saul sits at the feast with his other nobles. And we're told, of course, Jonathan is there and Abner is there. David is conspicuously absent, and Saul wonders about it, but Saul doesn't say anything. He figures that David is staying away because he must be ceremonially unclean. That's why David's not at the feast. When David's seat is empty again the next day, Saul begins to get suspicious. And so Saul asks Jonathan about it in verse 27. He says, "Why is the son of Jesse?" He won't call David by his name, and I think this is a sign of his contempt. "Why has the son of Jesse not come to the feast yesterday or today?" And then Jonathan tells the story, the cover story, the alibi, the lie, just as they had planned. "David asked my permission to go to Bethlehem for a family sacrifice with his brothers." But Saul doesn't buy it. Saul doesn't buy the lie, and he explodes in anger, challenging Jonathan across the table and really making a big scene in his own dining hall. He calls Jonathan the son of a perverse, rebellious mother. That's like saying, "You take after your wicked mother." That's basically what Saul says to Jonathan. He's insulting Jonathan and his mother. And I'll tell you this, just as an aside, that tells you a good bit of what Saul was really like. What a man is like in his home life, that's what he's really like. This tells you what Saul's marriage must have been like. Saul stupidly blames his wife. The reality is the exact opposite. I'm guessing that Jonathan probably had a godly mother, and that's part of how Jonathan turned out so well himself. The reality is this: Jonathan is actually the righteous son of a perverse and rebellious father. That's the reality. Saul says to Jonathan, "You've chosen the son of Jesse over me to your own shame and to the shame of your mother." And then he explains why he thinks Jonathan is being so foolish. He says, "As long as the son of Jesse lives, you cannot become king. Now bring him to me, for he shall surely die." Earlier, Saul had taken an oath in the name of God that David will surely live. Now he says, David will surely die. What's he doing here? This is what tyrants always do. Tyrants try to bribe people with empty promises, and that's what Saul is doing here with Jonathan. Saul says, "If you hand David over to death, then Jonathan, you can be king. If you hand David over to me, we put him to death, you get to be king, Jonathan." Saul is appealing to Jonathan's envy. He's saying, "Look, David is actually your rival. He's not your friend, he's your rival. He's the one blocking you from taking the throne." But Jonathan, being a good man, refuses to fall for it. Politicians are always making false promises to their people. Jonathan knows this is one of them. See, the best way to resist tyranny is to resist the sin of envy, because it's your envy that politicians will so often appeal to. Envy makes you vulnerable to manipulation by tyrants, but Jonathan doesn't fall for it here. Jonathan doesn't take the bait. Jonathan, no doubt, remembers what Samuel said back in chapter 13 when Saul sinned. The punishment for that sin was that Saul would not have a dynasty. 1 Samuel 13, that's the judgment that Samuel passes against Saul. Saul thinks that if David is killed, the throne will go to Jonathan and Saul can have this dynasty. In Saul's way of thinking, it's either David or Jonathan, and David is standing in the way, so let's eliminate him and then Jonathan can have the throne after me. Jonathan knows what the Lord has promised. Jonathan knows the Lord's judgment. He knows the Lord judged his father Saul. He knows that the Lord has anointed David to be king in waiting. Saul will not have a dynasty no matter what. David will be king. God has made that clear, and that's what Jonathan believes. And so in verse 32, it's like they're holding court. Jonathan seeks to defend David. It's an echo, really, of David's own questions at the start of the chapter. Why should David be killed? What has he done? Now, obviously, there are no answers to those questions. David has not done anything. Nobody here could legitimately think that David is guilty of some terrible crime. David is innocent. He is righteous. He's done the right thing all along the way. David is hated by Saul because Saul is an envious man. Saul hates David because the Lord is with David and has blessed David. And so earlier, Saul's anger was starting to erupt. Now his anger really explodes. And Saul does what he always seems to do when he gets really angry. He hurls a spear at Jonathan, just as he had done with David several times before. Jonathan sides with David, and so Jonathan gets the David treatment. Think of what Jesus said to his disciples in John 15. He says, they're going to hate you because they hated me. They're going to hate you for my sake. Jonathan is hated for David's sake. Jonathan is treated as David has been treated. Saul hates David, and so he hates those associated with David, including his own son. This is a proxy war. And you need to understand, all persecution of the church is a proxy war. Jesus is the one they hate. They can't get to Jesus because he's in heaven. And so what do? They attack his followers. That's the closest they can get to Jesus. They can't get Jesus, so they come after us. That's how persecution works. And that's what Saul does here. David is out of reach, and so he goes after David's best friend, David's most loyal supporter, the one who was in covenant with David. And Saul makes false accusations. This is another satanic strategy, to make false accusations. Saul says to Jonathan, again, that Jonathan is shameful. He calls Jonathan rebellious and shameful, when really Jonathan has been noble, loyal, wise, and humble the whole time. In fact, Jonathan has believed the best of his father for probably longer than he should have. That's how noble Jonathan is. Saul here is calling good evil and evil good. Saul is the shameful one. Saul is the rebellious one. Saul is the perverse one. Now, when Saul throws his javelin, his spear at Jonathan, he misses, as usual. I get the sense that Saul was either not very good at spear throwing because he's got all these short-range misses, or God was somehow protecting his targets. That's perhaps even more likely. Jonathan left the table before eating, so Jonathan is now fasting. He's understandably angry. The text tells us he's angry, and rightfully so. I think we're supposed to see a contrast here between Jonathan's righteous anger and Saul's wicked anger. So we'll realize there is such a thing as righteous anger. And of course, we're also told that Jonathan is grieved. Jonathan is saddened by all of this. His father has treated him shamefully. His father's wickedness is now confirmed. And Jonathan now knows his best friend David is going to have to leave. And so the next morning, the fourth day, Jonathan goes out into the field with the boy where David was hiding, and he uses the arrow signaling system that they had agreed upon, and he shot the arrow a long way off as a sign that, yes, Saul is angry, and David, you need to flee. You need to take refuge. When the servant returns with the arrows, Jonathan sends his weapons and the boy away into the city. And Jonathan and David, this is one of the interesting things about the story, because then Jonathan and David talk with one another, and you might think, well, why did they need this whole secret arrow system if they're going to get to meet and talk? Well, I don't think they knew they were going to get to meet and talk. I think they were wondering, are we going to be under surveillance the whole time, and you're just going to have to flee in secret? As it turns out, they're not being watched, and so they get at least a few minutes with each other to say goodbye. And so we get a description of this beautiful parting of best friends in verses 41 and 42. It really is a beautiful farewell scene. There's really not anything else that I know of that rivals it. Maybe in Acts chapter 20, when Paul is saying farewell to the Ephesian elders for the last time, and as Luke gives his description, he kind of lingers over it. You've got the same kind of thing here. David bows before Jonathan three times as a way of saying thank you, honoring Jonathan for sparing his life. They kiss, they hug, they weep together. These are two close friends who know this is it. We're even told that David wept more. I think that's because David is the one who's going away. David is the one who's going to have to give everything up and flee into the wilderness. And David and Jonathan will hardly ever see one another again. David is about to be homeless. He's about to be an outcast. He's about to be an outlaw on the run, a permanent fugitive in Saul's kingdom, the most wanted man in Saul's kingdom. And what does Jonathan say to him? Jonathan says, go in peace. Now, that might seem like a rather ridiculous thing to say, given the circumstances. Go in peace. How can Jonathan wish Saul peace? How can Jonathan wish David peace in this set of circumstances? Saul is at war with David. How can David have peace? Well, Jonathan here is not joking. He's not mocking. He is praying God's peace upon David. And this is one of the amazing things about being a believer, one of the amazing things about the life of faith, about being a Christian. It's this: we can live in peace even when surrounded by chaos. We can be at peace even when surrounded by war. And that's because as God's people, our peace does not depend on things being peaceful around us. We can have peace in our hearts even when there is no peace in our circumstances. That's what Jonathan is affirming and praying for David here. He's praying that Jonathan is praying that David would experience the peace of the Lord, that even as he goes off into the wilderness, even as he goes off into the wilderness, that he would know the Lord's peace. Even as Saul is at war with him, that he would know God's peace. Now, what are the lessons we can draw from this story? I want to draw one lesson from David and one lesson from Jonathan. One lesson from what David does here and one lesson from what Jonathan does here. The whole story basically shows us why David is going to have to flee, why he's going to have to go live as a fugitive and an outlaw in the wilderness for at least the next 10 years of his life. So it's going to be a big chunk of David's life spent in the wilderness. Now, you might wonder why. I think it's a very legitimate question. Why didn't David flee already? Why did he hang around for so long? Saul's been trying to kill him for quite a while. Why has he not already fled into the wilderness? Well, remember, David had been brought into Saul's service. Saul was his master, even a kind of father to him, and certainly a father-in-law. But David had been bound to King Saul as one of his servants, part of his inner circle in his military and all of that. And so even after Saul has made multiple attempts on David's life, David still has a deep sense of duty. He's got a sense of duty to Saul and to the nation of Israel. He knows that fleeing will likely be necessary, but he did not want to make a rash or reckless decision. He wanted to be really sure. And that's a big part of what this chapter is about. This section of the book, this section of 1 Samuel, starts with David going to Saul and being bound to Saul. This section ends with David leaving Saul for good. But before David leaves, he needs to be completely sure that there is no possibility of reconciliation with Saul. And so he gives Saul one last chance before he leaves. He's got such a deep sense of obligation to Saul. See, his sense of duty runs deep. David's sense of duty runs deep. And we can learn from that, since in our day, this sense of duty or honor or loyalty is almost entirely missing. We can learn from David, since in our day we have almost no sense of duty or honor or loyalty. In our culture, we just tend to do what we feel like. We treat relationships as disposable. We feel no sense of obligation to those God puts in authority over us. No sense of obligation to honor them. No sense of obligation to our own people. David here is exceedingly patient with his elder, with this older man. Saul might be envious, irrational, short-tempered, but he's still the king. He's still an older man. He is David's father-in-law. And so David is going to honor him as fully as he can for as long as he can. What we see here, and especially in the following chapters, is that David had many chances to rebel, many opportunities to become a vigilante, many opportunities to take justice into his own hands, as it were, many opportunities to be a revolutionary. Saul tried to kill David. David had many opportunities. He will have many opportunities to kill Saul. But David doesn't take the bait. He never becomes a revolutionary. He never takes what is not his. Yes, he does fight to defend himself. We will see that. He will defend himself in various ways. But he does not seize power for himself in a revolutionary way. He doesn't take the throne. He waits patiently for God to exalt him, for God to give him the throne when the time is right. See, you got to understand, Israel was a very divided nation at this point. You even saw that in the Song of the Women. After David killed Goliath. Israel was a political tinderbox at this time. David had many men who would have been loyal to him if he had tried to seize the throne prematurely. All it would have taken at this moment in Israel's history is one little spark, and the whole nation of Israel would have blown up into the blazes of a civil war. But David knew that was not the right thing. That was not the right tactic or the right strategy. It was not the right thing to do. And in fact, it would have been disastrous. And so David does not become a revolutionary. He doesn't become a vigilante. He waits for God to reward him with kingly glory in God's own time. David has been mistreated by Saul, but he did not return evil with evil. In fact, David turns the other cheek. David loves his enemy. David entrusts himself to the judgment of the Lord because he knows the Lord judges justly. Understand this. David is putting the principles of the Sermon on the Mount into practice 1,000 years before Jesus preached it. Think about the things Jesus preaches in the Sermon on the Mount. David is putting them into practice here long before Jesus preaches that sermon. He already knows. Saul's evil, I won't return evil for evil. I'm going to return evil with good. I'm going to turn the other cheek. I'm going to show mercy. I'm going to show forgiveness. I'm going to entrust myself to the Lord. Other than Jesus himself, David is probably the best and most complete biblical example we have of loving and forgiving an enemy. He is one of the best models we have of patiently respecting authority, showing patience even in the face of persecution. See, in this chapter, David is really trapped between a sense of duty and fearing for his life. But he doesn't let fear get in the way of duty. That's the thing. There was a time when that was common for men. Men would put duty above fear. That's not so common today. We need David's example. Another way to look at this is to think about it this way. There are parallels between David and Moses, or really you could say between David and Israel's exodus out of Egypt. If you go back to the book of Exodus, the Israelites, of course, have been enslaved by Pharaoh. And interestingly, when Moses goes to Pharaoh, he asks permission for his people to leave Egypt, initially to go out into the wilderness and have a feast. But then later, of course, to leave altogether. But Moses goes to Pharaoh and asks permission. Pharaoh is given every chance to do the right thing. Moses honors Pharaoh's office. Moses goes to Pharaoh and says, "Let my people go." That verb, "let me go," that root verb, that is the same verb that is used of David or by David 4 times in 1 Samuel chapter 20. The story uses the vocabulary of the Exodus to describe what David needs, where David is headed. It's translated a little bit differently, but it shows up in verses 5, 13, 22, and 29. That same verb, "let me go," was also used 5 times in chapter 19 for David as he was seeking to escape from Saul. See, David needs an escape. He needs an exodus. And obviously, we're supposed to make the connection here, if you catch this, This same vocabulary that's being used here, we're supposed to make all the connections. Saul is like Pharaoh, and he's treating David like a slave rather than a son. And it's about time for David to be set free, to have an exodus, and to go into the wilderness like Israel. It's interesting that later in 1 Samuel chapter 25, David is going to meet Nabal. And Nabal's name means fool, and he is a very foolish man. And we'll see what happens to him when we get there. But this is worth noting here. He accuses, this is another one of those false accusations, he accuses David of being an insurrectionist and a revolutionary. Nabal says, "Who is this David, the son of Jesse?" He says, "There are many servants nowadays who break away from their masters." He basically says, David is just one more servant who broke away from his master Saul. He's just an insurrectionist and a revolutionary. He's a rebel. Why should I listen to him? And of course, David is angered by this because it's a false charge. It's a dishonest insult. That's the very thing David has not been. He could have been, but he wasn't a rebel or a revolutionary or an insurrectionist. Nabal's wrong, just like Saul was wrong.
David's long-suffering. He obeys the fifth commandment and honors authority. He endures all kinds of suffering and hardship and mistreatment in the name of doing his duty. And of course, all of this is because God is at work in David's life to prepare him for kingship. David was a victim of horrific injustice, and he is a model for us when we have to deal with injustice as well. And I would say that suffering that injustice at the hands of the king was one of the best ways to prepare David for being king himself. Suffering at the hands of the current king was one of the best ways God prepared David to be king himself in the future. Very often, the best leaders are those who have suffered and sacrificed the most on their way to the top. Suffering is preparation for glory. The way to glory, the way to honor, to exaltation, the road to glory and exaltation is a hard, winding road full of obstacles, difficulties, trials. It's full of suffering. There is a message for us in our misfortune. That's what we need to understand. God is at work in our hardships, the injustices that we endure. God is at work.
At a commencement address, John Roberts told this to the graduates. I like his words. You may have heard me use some of these before, but I like this and I think it fits here. Listen to what he's told these graduates. They're about to go out. You know, they're all excited. They're graduating. And this is what he says to them. He says, commencement speakers will typically extend good wishes to you. I will not do that, and I'll tell you why. From time to time in the years to come, I hope you will be treated unfairly so that you will come to know the value of justice. I hope that you will suffer betrayal because that will teach you the importance of loyalty. Sorry to say, but I hope you will be lonely from time to time so that you don't take friends for granted. And when you lose, as from time to time you will, I hope every now and then your opponent will gloat over your failure. It is a way for you to understand the importance of sportsmanship. I hope you will be ignored so that you know the importance of listening to others, and I hope you will have just enough pain to learn compassion. And then he says, whether I wish these things or not, they are going to happen. And whether you benefit from them or not will depend upon your ability to see the message in your misfortune. When you suffer, what is God telling you? What is God teaching you? God is preparing you for glory. That's the message in your misfortune. You have to suffer all kinds of ways on the road to glory. You can't be a good leader unless you've suffered some on your way to the top. That's just how it is. That's what we learn from David. But we learn from Jonathan here as well. Jonathan is a man of such sterling and noble character. He's about to drop out of the story, and I got to tell you, I'm going to miss him when he's gone because he doesn't show up much after this. And it's just everything about Jonathan is just so glorious. He's such a splendid character. In a book that is full of fathers and sons, the noblest son of them all is not a son of Eli or a son of Samuel or even a son of David, but a son of wicked Saul. We've looked at Jonathan's friendship with David already. In a past sermon, I focused on that. Obviously, that is a theme here as well, their friendship. We see them make promises to each other. We see them pledge to help each other. We see their love for each other. All of that is wonderful. But I want to focus on something else. Jonathan shows us how to live under tyranny. And that's a lesson that might come in handy for us at some point. Jonathan shows us how to live under a tyrant. Jonathan shows us how to prioritize our loves and our loyalties when they're being pressured. Saul is definitely a tyrant, and Jonathan does the right thing here in dealing with that tyranny. Jonathan's friendship with David, you have to understand, is actually more than an ordinary friendship, and you get the sense of that from the way that they're constantly making covenants with each other. We don't usually seal friendship with a covenant. And that's fine. This is rather unusual. And it is because Jonathan knows who David is. Remember, David is the Lord's anointed. He is the king in waiting. He's the Messiah of his generation, a prototype of the ultimate Messiah to come. He is a preview of the last Adam. His kingdom will foreshadow Christ's kingdom. Jonathan knows this, that David is the one who will foreshadow the Messiah.
Jonathan treats David the way he does, not merely out of friendship, but out of faith. He knows he's not just dealing with an ordinary man here. He's dealing with God's Messiah, God's anointed one, the one who points ahead and who will pave the way for the coming of the ultimate Messiah. Jonathan's confidence is not just in David the man, but in the promises he knows God has made to David. It's not just that Jonathan looks at David and sees a friend. It's that he looks at the promises God has made to David, and he believes those promises. Despite all appearances to the contrary, despite the fact that David is obviously a long, long way from the glory of the throne and is about to get even further away as he goes out into the wilderness, nevertheless, Jonathan believes. Jonathan trusts in the promises of God. He trusts that David is the rightful king and that God will exalt him in due time. And everything else flows from that faith. And so Jonathan's devotion to David in some way is a picture of the Christian's devotion to Christ, who is the greater David. The way Jonathan views David is a faint picture of the way the Christian views the Christ. Think about this. David's promise of hesed, his promise of loving kindness to Jonathan, his promise to not destroy Jonathan and his house when he destroys his enemies, that too is a picture of what Jesus does for those who are in covenant with him. If you look at how Jonathan relates to David from their very first interaction in chapter 18 all the way through their last extensive interaction, which is here, it really is interesting. Jonathan loves David, he trusts David, his soul delights in David, he serves David, he loves David as he loves his own soul. He's got a certain perspective on David's calling and David's future because of his faith in God's promises, the promises God has made to and about David. And so while his friendship with David is critical to all of this, there is much more at stake here than just a friendship. In verse 15, note this, Jonathan says when, not if, but when the Lord cuts off your enemies, when the Lord cuts off your enemies, be merciful to me and my household. Jonathan chose loyalty to David over his own father, and it was the right thing to do in this particular case. Loyalty to family, of course, is important. But it is more important to be loyal to the Lord's anointed. That's the choice Jonathan makes. He had to choose between his father and the Lord's anointed. He chose the Lord's anointed. Jonathan had as much devotion for David as you can have for a mere man without sinning, without it becoming idolatry, if I can put it that way. We ought to have an even greater devotion to the greater David. Look at Jonathan's devotion to David. You should have an even greater devotion to the Lord Jesus Christ. Because he's not just a mere man like David, he is the God-man. And so we should love Jesus and delight in him and serve him. We should have full confidence that he will defeat our enemies and full confidence that he will be kind to us when he does so. Your soul should be knit to Jesus' soul. You should give him your weapons and your wealth as Jonathan did with David. You should pledge to him your undying allegiance. Jonathan seeks first the kingdom of David, the way that you should seek first the kingdom of Jesus. Jonathan kisses David. You should kiss the Son, as Psalm 2 says, kiss the Lord's anointed, the way Jonathan kissed David. Jonathan relied on the hesed of David, the loving kindness and covenant faithfulness of David, and you can rely on the loving kindness and faithfulness of Jesus. That's what you must do. If you find yourself living under tyranny, do what Jonathan did. Be loyal to the true king, to the Lord's anointed, even when it's costly. Your ultimate loyalty is not to an earthly king. Your ultimate loyalty is to the Lord Jesus. If you're forced to choose between unfaithful blood relations and fellow believers, go with the believers every single time. It's faith over family. Water is indeed thicker than blood. That's the lesson. How do you live under tyranny? How do you live when your loyalties are being squeezed and tested? You're to put love and loyalty towards the Lord Jesus and towards his people above everything else. Love, trust, and serve the greater David, the Lord Jesus. Give your life to him. Make covenant with him. Serve him always. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit, amen.